Hello and welcome to the MS Educast, your Educast about education by EMS educators for EMS educators, whoever else happens to show up and talk to you. And tonight we have a pretty cool show lined up. It is one of our second journal club, right?
Yes.
And yes, part two for the journal club.
I do. I like a little bit of French in there. It's nice. Nice touch.
And we've been really being weird for the last few minutes anyway, so forgive us.
Especially given the recent close relationship between Canadian and American hockey teams. You know, that's good. I like it.
All right.
It was very close.
It was good, wasn't it? I'm looking forward to we're looking forward to beating your butts in Buffalo next year.
Man. Anyway.
I want to say kick your asses, but I can't remember if that's okay or not in Educast land.
What are we playing?
It is now.
In Buffalo?
Yeah, I think the next game or next series is in Buffalo.
Man.
Oh,
the junior hockey series.
What?
Oh man, do you guys not follow?
Yes,
no.
Yes. You need to get up to date on this. Come on.
There's ice there.
Help us out,
do
Bill.
That. Anyway, who you're listening to is Rob Terrio from Ontario, Canada. Say hi to everybody, Rob.
Hello. Great to be back. Good to talk. I was going to say see you guys, but good. I can see your names on my screen.
There you go.
Hear you guys again. Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year. And also you heard Greg Friess, which is another one of our co-hosts.
Happy New Year, everybody. And, you know, when we first had Rob on this show, he used a little bit of that Monty Python accent. And our numbers went through the roof, and maybe we got to have more of that. So, Rob, if you
really, I wasn't aware of that little statistic. That's good to know.
I'm making it up, but
oh, okay.
I've done some research, and I'll fill you in later.
I was just about to break out into Monty Python, but I'll hold off now.
And blogger extraordinaire Tim Noonan, how are you doing, Tim?
I'm doing all right. And what CMS without Monty Python?
You're right. Mm-hmm. That does work. And Blair Bingham, who I'm not totally familiar with. Blair, how are you doing tonight? And introduce yourself so I can.
I'm very good. It's Blair Bingham from Toronto, Canada. Actually logged in from Phoenix, Arizona, down here at the National Association of EMS Physicians meeting, where we're talking about a couple cool topics around patient safety and provider safety. But tonight's topic is resuscitation, something near and dear to my heart. I'm a resuscitation researcher in Toronto, Canada, where I also practice as a land and flight paramedic.
Oh, cool. So did Rob bring you on here?
He did, yeah. He suckered me into coming out for the last journal, and I loved it so much. Here I am again.
Well, if you're terrible at this, we'll blame him.
Thanks. Voluntold.
You got to blame the Canadians for something.
Would make them feel at home.
Sure, sure. And that's what we're all about. We love Blair. And we're going to find out
what
Blair is.
They were almost part of the United States.
That's right.
Oh, stop, please.
You just got lucky.
See, Canada is eventually going to annex the U.S. because we're a larger country and we have room for you guys.
It's too cold.
Careful what you wish for.
I'm not sure if it's too cold or not. I think you guys are having a more wicked winter than we are right now.
Yeah.
Colder temperatures, bigger snow dumps.
I got to go back to work after this just to make sure I can be there in the morning. Because it's supposed to snow on me.
You're going to have to come north to warm up.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, when we do our journal club,
You've got one more guy in the room.
What?
Bill Toon.
No, I talked. Oh, Bill Toon's in here too?
Yeah.
Bill, I'm sorry, Bill. You know, you were whited out. It looks like you're not on, you're invisible on Skype. But
I don't know why.
But you're still there. Well, no, you've got your thing whited out. But Bill Toon, hello again.
Hi, Buck.
I feel
hello,
so
everyone
bad.
Else. That's okay. Happy New Year to everyone.
Happy New Year.
Thanks, Bill.
Happy New Year.
That's awesome. And all the listeners in the Talk Shoe posse.
Yay.
With the EMS Funky Bunch. Cool. All right. Well, what we usually do, after I forgot Bill. That's
well,
right.
You can't see him on the radio.
I know. I think I've insulted Bill more than I insulted Blair. So the heat's off Blair for a minute.
Oh, you're leaving me out?
I'll get you, Tim. I'll get you in a minute.
I'm hurt.
Well, what we usually do, and correct me if I'm wrong, I say usually, we've done this once before, and this probably won't look anything like the last time. Probably be more of a train wreck. But what we're supposed to do is everybody who had a reading assignment is supposed to give a little 5-minute presentation on their assigned paper that we're gonna that is relevant to EMS in some way, although it might not be directly about EMS, but should be relevant. And then we'll fight tooth and nail about it, maybe, and then come to some conclusion. Am I close, Greg, or am I way off here?
You're pretty close, and I can go first if you'd like. I don't know if we set up a order, but I've got right here in front of me from the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, article titled Intravenous Drug Administration During Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest, a randomized trial, and this was from Oslo, Norway, and what they were looking at was, did it make a difference to cardiac arrest patients? Was there a difference in the number that survived to hospital discharge if they got intravenous drugs during ACLS? And what they found, I'll get to the point real quickly, is that there was no statistical difference in survival to discharge between the two groups of patients, patients that got drugs before ROSC and patients that did not get drugs before return of spontaneous circulation. And so, you know, what they were looking at was this question, is that, you know, epinephrine, is it helpful specifically? And so with that in mind, it was a randomized trial. So at the point that the paramedics arrived on scene, they would open a card and it would tell them if this was intravenous drug administration group or intravenous no intravenous, and they've had almost 1,200 patients. I think one of the things that, as I was I read this article a couple times, and as I reread it this afternoon, one of the things that kind of caught my eye on the second reading was that, you know, they had almost 1,200 patients, but in the end, they were only able to include 851 of them, and so, you know, slightly more than 300 patients were excluded for some sort of reason that, you know, they shouldn't have ever been enrolled in the study in the first place. And so that was kind of interesting, just that piece. And then, you know, one of the things that they did find is that, you know, they had more of the patients that, you know, so they had this overall question and then they kind of drilled it down into some different areas. You know, in the drugs group, the group that received drugs, more of them got a pulse back. But in the end, it didn't lead to any difference in terms of discharge from the hospital, neurologically intact. And then also they looked at this piece of, well, you know, if the was it a shockable rhythm, and patients in V-fib, whether they got drugs or not, seemed to fare about the same. Patients that were in PEA, for example, and got drugs had ROSC, but there wasn't survival to discharge. So, you know, it's a study, and kind of with the conversation we had last time about research and, you know, some of Tim's input and some of the blogging he did afterwards, is, you know, there's a lot more questions left here to be asked in research than are necessarily answered. But and then another interesting point here is that they were able to control for a lot of different variables, like the quality of CPR, was it the location that the arrest occurred, was there the ages of the patients, bystander witness intervention, those sort of things. So again, the study was intravenous drug administration during out-of-hospital cardiac arrest, a randomized trial. So that's just a little bit about this study.
One of the things that's interesting is this this study crosses over from 2003 to 2008, where there were, you know, a couple of guidelines, or at least one guideline change in there. And, you know, it certainly begs the question in my mind, and Blair could maybe speak to this from his research, you know, with the new guidelines and people surviving after more prolonged CPR now, will ALS drugs make a difference in those prolonged arrests? You know, those patients who are surviving after 30, 40 minutes of CPR now, who, you know, previously were considered really unresuscitatable or you know, couldn't be resuscitated with a full neurological recovery prior to the changes in the guidelines and the implementation of hypothermic therapy and those kinds of things.
So, it's Blair here. I think those are all really, really good points. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah, we can now.
So, first of all, regarding this study, I think it's a really neat, gutsy study to do. To go ahead and say, you know, we're not going to start IVs. We're not going to give people drugs. So I think the idea that they were actually able to pull this off as a scientific study is awesome. Now, when we're talking, you guys have already pointed out that we can see that there is a difference in return of circulation. In the different rhythms, there's even a difference in terms of being admitted to a hospital in ICU. But we still have this insignificant difference to discharge. And would that change over time? Absolutely. As we get better CPR, we already know that our survival rates, at least in Ontario, have doubled since 2005. And we see a lot more therapeutic hypothermia happening in hospitals as well. So I think all of that sort of draws into question the very long period of time that this study took data over. But I don't think that should completely get it tossed out. Another really cool thing about this study, or sorry, I shouldn't say a cool thing, but something that's surprising, is that they were able to do this study with only about 1,000 patients. And for most cardiac arrest studies, we aim for 15,000 patients. Certainly for the ITD study and the early versus late study, we were looking for a lot more patients. So it would be interesting to see if this study were done on a much larger scale, would we see those differences in increased ROSC and increased admission to hospital that seem to be attributable to IV drug use, would those pan out into survival to discharge? And I think that's an interesting question that has to be answered before we go and toss all the drugs out of the ambulance.
Hey, Blair, one of the questions I have in the statistical analysis section, they talked about how they determined with what they call the power analysis, how many patients they thought they would need to enroll in the study. But I wasn't sure what a power analysis was. Is that something that you're familiar with?
Yeah, whenever we look at a study's ability to determine the power of for its power to determine a difference, we're sort of, it's similar to how we ask for significance. So we ask for a p-value, right? We want to know what are the odds that what we're seeing isn't actually true. But we also want to know what are the odds that this study is actually capable of finding a difference. So a lot of studies will say there is no difference when there might actually be a difference. So that's another type of error. We call it the beta error. And so it's sort of the opposite of the p-values and the statistical significance piece. Is this study big enough to actually see a difference? So when we look here, and forgive me if my numbers are off, but I think they were talking about seeing almost a 100% difference in survival. Let me just find it here. So with the projected...
Yes, that was what they expected.
Yeah, so projected survival rate of 7% in the intravenous group and 14% in the no intravenous group. That's a 100% difference based on each intervention. So that's a fairly significant clinical difference to expect to find. And the larger the difference, obviously the less number of patients you would need to get there. So if I thought that an intervention would quadruple survival rates, I wouldn't have to enroll that many patients. But if an intervention is only going to improve survival by 5%, which I think we would all agree in cardiac arrest is fairly significant, I would have to enroll many, many, many more patients to see that same effect. To give you an example, the OPAL study, which I think most people are familiar with, that was operated in Ontario to see if ALS paramedics had higher survival rates than BLS EMTs, it found that there was no statistical difference, but it was designed to catch a 40% survival increase. And I don't think any of us think an ALS paramedic is going to improve your chances of survival by 40%. So it came back statistically insignificant given its expected effect of 40%. So this study has an even larger effect size, and I just don't think that's all that realistic. So if we were to use a much more modest effect size, we would probably need a much higher sample size.
Claire, you raise a really interesting point I'd never heard before, that the expectation or that they were looking for a 40% increase in survival from ALS care. So clearly that was not significant, but if they had set their expectations lower to say a 5%, would the results have been considered significant? Am I understanding that concept correctly?
You're correct in your understanding. The problem is, at a 40% effect difference, they enrolled 1,300 patients or so in each cohort. If you wanted to get a 5% difference, you'd probably have to enroll closer to 12 or 15 or 18,000 patients into a study. And to do that pre-hospitally, we know that ROC has recently done it for the ITD. They enrolled well over 10,000 patients to find there was no statistical difference. 10,000 patients is a lot of patients to enroll. But if we really want to answer cardiac arrest questions in a reasonable way, I think we need to have much larger sample sizes in general, unless we can find that magic bullet that's going to shoot survival way up.
So do you think it's reasonable then to question the validity of the statement that ALS doesn't make a difference from the OPAL study? Is that?
I think the OPAL study was a wonderful pre-hospital study, but I think it has several limitations when it comes to concluding that ALS and BLS are equal in terms of patient outcome. So I think we need to take OPALs with a grain of salt and recognize that there's certainly no massive effect when you add ALS to a system. Is there a modest effect? There could be, and we still don't know the answer to that. I think that's why after OPALs, we still have the propagation of ALS throughout North America.
Well, it's incredible to hear you say that, because in the service that, where I used to work for the base hospital, we tracked local statistics, and we had about 500 cardiac arrests a year. I can't remember the number of which were in shockable rhythms, but we found that survival rates for patients who received advanced life support was around 13%, compared with about 7 to 8% for BLS care. So we never really talked about it a whole lot because it just didn't seem to jive at all with OPALs. But what you're saying makes sense.
Yeah. No.
What kind of survival?
In the statistics we tracked, you mean?
When survival you say, to the hospital, survival.
Oh no
to
no no no! We used the Utstein criteria, so they had to survive neurologically intact. At that time we used the cerebral performance category. I think it was a one they had to have, so they had to be discharged from hospital with essentially the same neurological status they came in with. So yeah, it was survival to discharge.
That's an excellent point to bring up, that usually when we talk about survival, a long time ago, survival used to be survival to the ED, right? We got them there with a pulse, we did a good job. But now a lot of, when most researchers publish survival data, they're talking about survival to discharge with neurologic function, with good neurologic function.
Mm-hmm.
So that's important, that we're not just talking about making it to the ER or making it to the ICU. And this paper here on IV drug use did a wonderful job of breaking it down by ROS, arrival to hospital, admission to ICU, and then actual survival.
Should we start talking about one of the other papers here?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not before yet. Hold on. Sorry.
Hold your horses there.
Go ahead, Tim.
There are a few other things about this. For one thing, the way they look at what is the intervention. No drug is considered the intervention, while continuing with the ALS medication is considered the control.
Hello?
I'm here.
Uh-huh.
And
are you hearing me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You're back.
Okay. We shouldn't be treating patients until we have evidence that what we're doing is beneficial for them. So far, we have no evidence that any of the ALS interventions improve outcome. It used to be that CPR was considered something only done by doctors, and fibrillation was only done by doctors, but now they're BLS. But they're the only things that have been shown to work. If you read the ACLS textbook, it says that specifically in there. In spite of all 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 spite of Alden's outcome with good neurological function is improved by any ALS intervention.
So that's a really good point, but I think it's also important when we look at our current standards and whether or not we should change them or whether or not we should only go with things that improve neurologic survival at discharge. I think it's also important to note that we have some reasonable evidence that more people's heart gets started and more people make it to the emergency department and the ICU where they can then get more care. So I think there's reasonable evidence to suggest that giving these IV drugs isn't bad. It's not hurting people. It's in fact getting more people to definitive care and to more advanced assessment where they can get catheterization, et cetera. We've just never been able to show with a large enough sample size that those benefits that we see early on make it all the way to discharge.
Yeah, it's
but how much
it's
damage
important.
Are we doing to get them there? We don't know what the long-term damage of these medications is. If there's a benefit, why isn't it showing up?
Well, it was
just because
it's
we're getting somebody to the hospital or even to the ICU with a pulse does not mean that we are improving their long-term outcome.
So
if I borrow money, I short-term have more money in my pocket, but long-term I have more debt.
So were you worried about let me back up here for a minute. This idea of the patient leaving the hospital neurologically intact is actually a fairly new one. And the HA wasn't the one that came up with it, but they championed it with part of their last CPR rollout and a little bit in the one before that. And the fact that they said, okay, look, we've been looking at getting people to the hospital alive. And if we did that, we patted ourselves on the back and we considered this drug to be working. Well, now we want to go a little bit farther with it. And we want to say, hey, you know, we want them to leave the hospital. Well, all of a sudden, when looked at under those new criteria, these drugs that we thought were working, and that's the big thing, thought were working, all of a sudden really didn't make that much difference with that new goal in mind. So it's important for the reader or the new student or somebody who's listening to this podcast to know that, you know, these things under a different set of criteria were actually working. But I guess now I've never really heard Tim's viewpoint is I guess Tim is actually going one step further and saying, well, the people who are getting out of the hospital, how do we know that, you know, all these doses of epi and atropine and everything aren't hurting them? Do I hear you right like that?
Yes. Look at the research that was done on high-dose epinephrine starting back in the 80s. These were patients who also had a higher resuscitation rate, return of spontaneous circulation admission to the hospital, than patients who were getting standard-dose epinephrine. Yeah. But we're no longer giving high-dose epinephrine. And the reason is it seems that there was more long-term neurological damage in the patients who were receiving high-dose epinephrine, even though all of the same things that we're seeing with standard-dose epinephrine were going on with the high-dose epinephrine. Improved return of spontaneous circulation, improved admission to the hospital. But the long-term outcome was worse because of the medication.
Well, I think there was also
that. We don't do that anymore.
Well, I think there's also that added layer that we're doing this to dead people. And, you know, it's hard to hurt a dead person. So that has a little bit behind it.
And it's
hard to hurt a dead person, but if the person has potential to have a good outcome, then it is harm.
So one of the things, and I think this is a wonderful discussion, it's one of the great things about research, and we may not come to a consensus on it on the call here, but I think that if we look at the people who don't get epinephrine, or who don't get IV drugs, they have a less chance of getting ROSC. And in my system, if you don't get ROSC, I pronounce you in your home or wherever you've collapsed. So I think it's really important that before we start taking things away that do get people one step closer to survival, we sort of ask ourselves, well, wait a minute. If we're getting them to the emergency department more often, how come they're not surviving more often? And can we improve our post-arrest care? And I know we have a couple articles coming up that discuss that.
And I think that the problem there is that there is damage somehow from the medication. It may be that it is because we're starting IVs and neglecting good BLS care, and all we need to do is improve the BLS care. It could be that epinephrine only improves the outcome for a select group of patients, and we need to identify them. But here's, we don't know.
Well, one of the things
we need to give Bill a chance to say something here.
Oh, okay.
Just I agree with everything that's been said, and I think Blair brings up a good point. But I want to just go back to some interesting things here about this patient population. And again, not sure how much you read, but it was interesting that the location of the cardiac arrest, the percentage of them is much different than what we're used to in the United States. It only showed a little over half happened in the home. And in most studies in the United States, over pretty close to 80% mm-hmm. are in home. I thought that was interesting. The percentage of bystander CPR was very high in both groups and witnessed arrest, which was very interesting. And then the one thing that I think is important, it says physician-staffed ambulance presence. That brings another interesting variable in here if we're trying to compare it to our practices here in North America. So there's just some other little subtle things here into this study that, again, Blair brought it out. We will not possibly reach consensus, but we can really talk a great deal about what is here and what's not here. So I just wanted to let you know, I found some of those things interesting that would require me to want to get a little bit more even into this than what's presented here.
Bill, I'm always jealous of the bystander CPR rate over in Europe. It's phenomenally high in almost every country you go to, and I'm not sure why it's so crappy in Canada and in the U.S., but the Europeans sure know how to get people down on their knees doing chest compressions.
Seattle, yes, they do.
Seattle's figured it out too, but
that's true, yes.
Not many other places. No, but one of the things I thought about just real quick is that, and I teach a post-resuscitation class, and one of the things that's really bothered me, at least about American ACLS and the way we're, medics are taught specifically over here, is it seems all the education seems to be revive the patient, revive the patient, revive the patient, hand them over. What they don't really cover, and what I learned in critical care and what I try to pass on to my students, is what happens, oops, my patient lived, what do I do now? It's hardly ever covered. And one of the things about epinephrine is it's kind of it's a dual-edged sword. It's a wonderful thing to revive a patient, but then it's the absolute last thing you want in somebody's bloodstream after you've revived them. And that's the kind of crux of it. And everybody's just thought about it as a necessary evil without thinking about it too much, but it's probably the wrong thing, hence vasopressin. Not having the dromotropic effect or inotropic effect and chronotropic effect. Vasopressin is just a pressor that makes CPR more effective without the added beta effects. However, that's not working either, according to the research. That shouldn't be changing things either.
I think we need to move on to our next article just because of the time.
Yeah.
And Rob, it sounds like you're ready to fire it up.
Okay, sure. Go. All right, well, this is an article published in Resuscitation by Elsevier, and it's the title of the article is Time Needed for a Regional Emergency Medical System to Implement Resuscitation Guidelines 2005. This is a Netherlands experience. This is was done in the Dutch province of North Holland, where they have a population of 2.6 million, and it's a urban-rural mix. And I'll just read some snippets from the abstract, because really the crux of this article is about how long it takes between when new guidelines are published and when those guidelines are actually implemented in EMS. And the abstract reads, in December 2005, updated guidelines were introduced worldwide and will be revised again in 2010. And the study looked to elucidate how long it takes to implement new guidelines. So this is a prospective observational study between July 2005 and 2008. And they excluded the usual suspects, you know, the overdoses and the traumas and the non-cardiac type of patients and those who had missing or otherwise unusable ECGs. And so they go on to state here, continuous ECGs were classified as either G1992, meaning guidelines 1992, guidelines 2000, guidelines 2005. And if at least, just move on to the next part here. So they found when they looked at CPR and defibrillation and pulse checks and so on, that 2% of cardiac arrests during that period used the 1992 guidelines, and 49% the 2000 guidelines were used, so almost half, even after the 2005 guidelines have been implemented, and about 36% used the 2005 guidelines. And so if they used a combination of 2000 and 2005 guidelines, they were considered intermediate, and that made up about 7% of the group. So basically, they concluded that it took a year and a half to effectively implement new resuscitation guidelines, which to me, quite frankly, is not all that surprising, you know, in our own system here. And, you know, most research takes about 10 years before it hits the road, if not longer. So, you know, it's no wonder these people are staying dead, because we can't bloody well get the research out there into the front lines.
Well, look,
you know, it's like...
But is the implementation of the new guidelines, is that the field personnel's shortcoming, or is that the medical directors and the service managers that need to update the protocols and then bring everyone in for training?
I tell you
Greg,
what, having
that is a great question. Yeah. That is a great question. Let me just tell you what they describe here. So they
came up with it.
They actually elucidate why it took so long to implement. So, first, the guidelines were, you know, had to be published, and then, they had to be released, and it took 4 months between the time the new guidelines were actually released and the time they were published, and then about another 9 months before. Protocols were changed within the EMS system, and then a couple months more before that information was disseminated to the trainers and then disseminated to the field paramedics. So really, it sounds like a combination of dissemination of information and the time it takes to implement the education piece. So, you know, I look at this, and one, it doesn't surprise me. Two, one of the things they conclude at the end here, which I don't agree with, is that they make this statement that the half year, it takes 1.5 years to implement new resuscitation guidelines in the Dutch EMS system. Okay, fine. The half year it takes to train all personnel is unavoidable. However, the 1.5 year delay is avoidable by abolishing the embargo, I love that word, embargo, on release of guideline changes to translators, so people that translate it into English, and policymakers, and adjusting the publication date to translating it from English to other languages, and adjusting the publication date of the national EMS protocols. I don't agree that you know, the half year it takes to train personnel is avoidable, because we're talking about CPR and we're talking about ALS, right? And these things are being disseminated to working paramedics, working EMTs. And so these are people who are experienced with CPR and defibrillation and so on. So, you know, quite frankly, you could Twitter this stuff and they could be doing it the next day. So I'm being tongue in cheek, but
I mean, it's, you know. Yeah.
Right. Frankly, I mean, there are more innovative ways to disseminate information through videos, through web-based education.
There is a human component to this, though, that I've found in teaching the new ACLS guidelines, is that especially with these guidelines, the last 2005, people were resistant to it for some reason. It taught people stuff that was counterintuitive to what they were taught when they went to school. And a lot of people didn't trust it. And if you just put a memo out saying to do this, it, you know, ventilate people less, they're not going to do it.
I think that's a good point. And you know what? The 2005 guidelines shook me up, quite frankly. This whole concept, you know, for example, of shocking and then going right back to CPR.
Right.
You know, there were a couple of times when I was running arrest and somebody said, Rob, we need to do CPR. And I'm going, oh, right, yeah, you know, because I'm reaching for the pulse. And but, you know, once I was shaken up, I think since we've all gone through that 2005 shakeup, I think, you know, we may be at a point now where we're ready for some, you know, significant changes like that in ALS guidelines or CPR guidelines. And I think there's a more effective way to disseminate it, but I think you can get it out quickly and then follow that up with, you know, additional training. So the kinesthetic aspect of the training is, you know, being sort of reinforced. But is it really necessary to train all the trainers over a 4 to 6 month period and then begin to train frontline personnel? Is that really necessary? I'm not convinced it is.
Certainly in North America, I know that Jocelyn in her paper there showed that there was that delay after the training occurred to when there was actually compliance. Mm-hmm. And I know in North America, that gap was around 7 months from, that's after they were trained. After field medics were trained in the new guidelines, it still took them about 7 months before they were actually performing them. And I think part of that is also muscle memory. When you've been running a cardiac arrest a certain way for 10 years, and all of a sudden you're told to run it completely differently, it takes providers a little bit of time to get used to that shift. And 17 months in Europe actually is phenomenal compared to what we did here in North America. It took up to 2.5 years in some EMS agencies here to just implement the new guidelines with the paramedics. So that doesn't include that 7 month learning curve. So we're talking about 3 years to get guidelines that we know have doubled survival out to patients. That's, I think we can improve on that quite a bit when the 2010 guidelines come out at the end of this year.
Mm-hmm. You know what,
educators really need to grab onto this. This is cool for educators because we can see that there's a gap after we train to when people actually perform optimally.
And absolutely.
Somewhere between 3 and 7 months, that's kind of cool. I think as educators, we really want to delve into that and say, how can we be more effective when we train people in new guidelines?
Bill, are you trying to jump in?
Yeah, there's this built-in fear about, well, first of all, we didn't, you know, typical in our system here, we're fortunate enough to have a group of, you know, we have a fairly small system in the sense that maybe we have a couple of hundred paramedics and maybe 300 EMTs. So we're relatively small. So we don't wait. We don't wait for the books to come out. We read the guidelines. We figure out how we're going to teach it, and we make the changes.
I like it.
There's a fear out there, I think, though, you can't do that. You know, people have asked us questions. You know, for example, we do CCR. And people says, how can you do something that's not the Heart Association? He says, we can't wait for the Heart Association because it takes too long. When there's something out there that, you know, you can see a dramatic difference and you can see a change. And if you really think about CCR, all that really is concentrating on high-quality chest compressions. You know, we just wait too long sometimes. And I think there's enough evidence out there, and I think someone said it already. If you wait for it to show up in a textbook, even with the electronic age, even by the time the textbook is published, there's already been maybe 10 well-published studies that have already changed what was written in that book.
That's an awesome point. We've done some really interesting qualitative research with 200 North American EMS agencies to see just why it took them so long. And one of their primary things was that it took too long to get instructors retrained and that it took way too long to get new training materials. And that there was some, not interference, but some delays from state and provincial regulatory bodies who said, no, you can't change your guidelines until you have printed materials. So I think that whole paradigm, all these different organizations that have their hand in the EMS cookie jar, we really need to look at that and see how we can streamline things when the 2010 guidelines come out.
And I think that that's where the role of the medical director is pivotal within a system, because absolutely, that's the person that can move it along.
Yeah, medical directors are huge change agents, and they can really be opinion leaders and get these guidelines out there a lot faster. Funny enough, another one of the barriers that EMS agencies reported were their medical directors. A lot of medical directors, even though the AHA came out with evidence-based guidelines, said, well, you know, in my hospital, I've been doing it this way for 20 years. I don't think we'll change.
Well, here's an interesting wrench in the mix. You know, we're talking about CPR guidelines. This is not a controlled act. Can paramedics move ahead and implement a new CPR guideline on their own without approval from a medical director? And I'm just throwing that out there, not necessarily for a lengthy discussion, but you know, you have to wonder if the evidence is there to support compressions only, for example, do we really need a change in medical directive to go ahead and do that? You know, is a medical director required for something like that? Or can a service as a whole make that decision without the medical director?
I think that's a very provocative question, Rob. I like it.
Yeah.
Like, Tim, do you have anything to add on this one before we move on to our next article? I've caught him typing while I asked that question. So.
Well, and I'm just going to tag on there. That's why services need medical directors, and they need to have a good working relationship with them because that can help move things along quicker.
Correct.
Agreed.
Well, Bill, do you want to launch into the article that you read? And
you didn't give me one.
I didn't.
No. You assigned everyone else one but me.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I felt left out.
Well, fuck you got one.
No.
I'm sorry.
I got to fix the computer. It's okay.
Blair? I don't know where Tim's at right now.
Where'd he go?
I'm here.
Oh.
It's on mute.
Sorry.
But I was saying move on to the next one because I added too much on the previous one.
Okay, well, why don't you – I assigned you an article, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
All right.
I got the entertaining one. It's looking at regional ones and out of hospital cardiac arrest, and surprisingly, they decided to use that for the title. The affiliation is interesting. Dr. Nickel is with the Department of Biostatistics, so this is much more statistically oriented. They're looking at the ROC studies, only 1 year worth of patients from May 1st, 2006 to April 30th, 2007. So the previous study has a little bit to do with this. How many of the people were actually using the 2005 guidelines at that point? If it took 2.5 years to implement them, maybe these were all pre-2005 guidelines, although the systems being studied have some of the more progressive medical directors that they were all, or if not all, close to all using the 2005 guidelines. 11,898 patients had resuscitation attempted. And this was out of, 20,520 cardiac arrests. It was basically 4 resuscitations attempted for every 3 patients with no attempt at resuscitation. And numbers get a little bit confusing, but when you break it down, they found only 8.1%, the highest overall resuscitation rate, when they looked at total number of cardiac arrests. When they broke by how many resuscitation attempted, that improved to about the low number from 1.1% to 3%. So they actually tripled their rate when they left out the patients where no resuscitation was attempted. When they just V-fib arrests, it improved again by about double. The wording they used on this was a little bit confusing. They would switch between adjusted, unadjusted, and there was one other term I used, which was kind of awkward. but how's the echo?
It seems the longer you talk for, the more it starts to echo. So I'm not sure why, what that is, but well, go ahead, or somebody else jump in.
The final resuscitation rate went up to 39.9%, essentially 40% in Seattle, and the low end of it was 7.7%. So the change from the baseline, the total of cardiac arrest was much more dramatic in the ones that had the lowest resuscitation rate. But one of the things was where the cardiac arrest. All you guys up in Canada seem to have really low cardiac arrest rates. The incidence of cardiac arrest in
Ottawa. Yeah, Blair, can you comment on that? Why the incident rate in Ottawa is so much lower?
Universal healthcare, guys. You got to get it.
Well,
we have a higher life expectancy in Canada.
Portland was also very low on a cardiac arrest rate.
So this is a weird paper. It's an excellent paper. It's the best epidemiology paper we've ever had on cardiac arrest, in my opinion. But the results are really, really interesting, that you can have such huge variation in outcome and incidence simply based on the city you live in. It's really, really quite shocking. Vancouver, Toronto, Ottawa, Portland and Iowa as well, there have much lower incidence rates than elsewhere. Why is that? I think we can only hypothesize. I'm not sure. One of the things that is nice about this paper is that it does provide different viewpoints. So it gives us our overall cardiac arrest that call 911. But then we also get just the people EMS treated. So those other 8,000 patients who are, in Ontario, we call them obviously dead. Some places call them legally dead or dead without treatment. These are decapitated, rigor mortis, lividity patients.
In the UK, they call them bloody dead.
Yes, very dead patients.
Or DRT, dead right there.
There you go.
I think it's actually more than just dead when they all dead when they all looted when they all looted patients with not a good this impact between EMS say, hey, somebody don't have something that specific fit our guideline obviously dead, but feel it is appropriate to treat this patient.
Sorry, you were cutting in and out there on my mic a little bit, so I couldn't quite hear you very well. But I think just if we go back to the overall variability here, there's a lot of questions that are raised about whether or not every city is providing the same standard of care to the people who suffer a cardiac arrest. And a lot of questions here about why in Dallas you have double the incidence rate that you have in Ottawa and Portland and Vancouver. Some very, very interesting socioeconomic and policy questions come out of this paper. It would be really neat if we could learn how these different places train their paramedics and whether or not, their paramedics, their EMTs, their firefighters, any EMS provider. It'd be interesting to see if the training that goes on has anything to do with some of the different variation we're seeing.
How's my?
Yeah, the echo is pretty unbearable, Tim. Sorry.
Stop. Is it still there?
Yeah, it's still there. Sorry.
Okay.
Let's
hear from Bill.
I just was going to add one of the interesting things when I was at the resuscitation conference, RUSC, down in the Heart Association thing in November. the statement was made, when you've seen one EMS system, you've seen one EMS system.
Absolutely.
And I think that that was such a profound statement. And Blair, you bring up some excellent points about we don't really understand what are the variables. And education is a prime example. I think there is such dramatic differences between particularly in the United States, how people are trained. And I think it can only have an effect when you get actually out into the practice.
Interesting. Was there another article, Greg?
There was there. There was four, right? Blair.
Well, if you can put up with a little more echo, there were a couple of things on that that were worth mentioning. If you look at Milwaukee's population served, they have almost 4,000, but Pittsburgh is listed as just under 400 population densities. So 4,000 square mile in Milwaukee versus 400 per square mile in Pittsburgh. The way the systems are broken up is not exactly equal here. So that's something else we need to consider. They're measuring different groups of people.
That's a really, really good point, that the populations in these different cities are probably very, very different in terms of distance from ambulance services, rural versus urban, the types of hospitals in the area. So a lot of very, very interesting questions, response times, things like that. However, Dr. Nickel and his colleagues did a really good job of controlling for some of that and some of the adjusted numbers when we look at survival. And they're still seeing this unexplained, unaccounted for difference that, you know, even when we consider every known variable that we can possibly think to collect, we still can't explain why these variations occur.
Well, I think we get a little bit ahead of ourselves when we try to explain why instead of trying to come up with hypotheses for future studies. Nice thing about this is the number of patients they were able to enroll in just a one-year period.
Right.
And I think that's the strength. That's what Rock is bringing to the science of resuscitation or EMS, is they're showing how the power that can be gained by collecting all this data, the epistry of the Rock is very impressive. And I just hope they can continue to get funding to help answer some critical questions still that are out there.
That's something that's important. We need to put pressure on the people who make decisions about that funding. We spend $250 million a year on alternative medicine studies, and the result is always the same. They don't work, and we can't afford a few million for this. This is great research. This is going to make a big difference in survival.
I just have one final question, actually, about this one, Blair or Tim. If it's sort of like, is the Seattle's numbers being so high painting a too rosy of an overall picture? Do they ever like throw out the highest and the lowest and say, well, let's really look at who's left in the middle?
I don't think you should throw out the highest and the lowest unless you give a good reason for it. And here, what we should be doing is trying to figure out why isn't everybody doing the same thing as the highest. And I think one of the things we learned from when Dr. Eisenberg was on is that they do a great job of encouraging bystanders to do CPR.
Right.
I think that is the biggest difference in the Seattle way of doing things.
Well, we've got one article left, Blair.
Absolutely. So my article, just let me pull it up here. I'm delving into this Nickel paper here. My article is not a scientific study. It's something a little bit different. It's a commentary. And it's called Level 1 Cardiac Arrest Centers, Learning from the Trauma Surgeons. So this is a very neat idea that is moving towards an evidence base. There's a number of trials going on right now around the world looking at this. The idea is that most patients with ROSC who arrive alive at hospital die. And why is that? So the paper points out that we used to have very high mortality rates from trauma until we implemented trauma systems and trauma centers, where you went to a specialty hospital, even if it was 30 minutes, 40 minutes further away than your closest hospital. In some cases, you bypass five or six other hospitals to get to this specialty center. That's high volume. They have expert trauma surgeons. They see a lot of trauma. Their nurses, their RTs are very accustomed to it. And they're very, very good at treating trauma patients. And survival rates skyrocketed for these severe trauma patients. So the authors suggest, well, why don't we do that for cardiac arrest centers? They say that, you know, there really aren't any post-arrest guidelines, something that we've already identified tonight. Whether you're a paramedic, EMT, or a physician, you kind of just make it up as you go. And they're very brave to suggest that a lot of post-arrest patients are marginalized and maybe written off as, you know, oh, well, let's just wait for them to die because there's nothing we can do for them. But with the new CPR guidelines, with therapeutic hypothermia, we see that survival rates are on the rise. So they've suggested that all post-arrest patients go to a specialty hospital where you have resuscitation experts who can determine whether or not the patient should be cooled and given hypothermia, to a cath center where they can have immediate catheterization. Because a lot of patients, and I found this very interesting, a lot of patients who have cardiac arrests, and we all know a lot of that is from a clot in their heart, they never get catheterized post-arrest. So their heart is still infarcting, and they just wait for a day or two until their heart has had enough, and they go into complete failure. They never get cathed.
And Blair, just real quick on that before you go on, and you know why they don't take them.
Yes, absolutely.
What's that? So what do you mean?
We know that.
I think it's important to mention that, Blair.
So we know that STEMI patients get really, really, really good care, and that a lot of EMS services are moving towards STEMI bypass to get your MI patients cathed as quickly as possible. And post-arrest patients who have very poor outcomes to begin with don't seem to be getting that really good care, despite evidence that early catheterization in post-arrest patients, and actually new evidence shows in intra-arrest patients, people without a pulse, catheterization can have a huge impact. So that's an area that the authors plead needs to be improved. And in the absence of catheterization, you can always consider thrombolytics, even after CPR. And in these specialty centers, hopefully their experts would be very, very good with managing hemodynamics in terms of pressors and fluids and antiarrhythmics. And then they would have experts in ventilation strategies to ensure that we had optimal ventilation, optimal blood gases without affecting cardiac output through increased PEEP and things like that. So this is a very cool concept. They're doing it in some places already in North America, and I'm just waiting for some published data to come out that shows just exactly what it's doing to outcomes. But this is a really neat commentary. I'd love to hear what you guys think. Here's the question that we posed to the educators. Are paramedics capable of transporting a post-arrest patient for 40 or 45 minutes to these post-arrest centers, maybe even longer? Normally, when I have a post-arrest patient, I want to get them the heck to the hospital and off my stretcher before they arrest again. So for you to then tell me, well, wait a minute, Blair, you're going to drive them all the way across the city or between cities to get to this resuscitation center of excellence. What do you guys think about that? Are paramedics ready for that step?
Why not?
I think we're getting there. I think with stroke bypass and STEMI bypass, I think, you know, our industry is getting used to that concept now, and I think the medics who work in rural areas, they know it. I mean, that's their life, right? But you know, it's the urban paramedics for whom that's a big adjustment. But I think it makes complete and utter sense. In utter sense, that's not what I meant to say. Complete sense.
I think they should be able to do it. And again, though, it's how do you define who these centers are? You know, is it someone who hangs a shingle out? And it gets into a whole question of how do you identify these places? What's the criteria that they have to meet and be held against? Are they going to be accredited by an outside organization? Yeah. At least with trauma centers, there is some there are criteria that are applied, whether you use the American College of Surgeons or at least a state-designated trauma system. And I think that that's a drawback. But I just want to take 1 second and just go back. Greg, the reason they don't take post-cardiac arrest patients to the cath lab is because the outcome typically in cardiac arrest patients is poor, and those deaths are held against the interventional cardiologist and affects their quality control that they're expected to maintain. So they don't like to take patients that are risky, regardless of the fact that there's a great deal of evidence out there that says it improves outcome.
And maybe that's where they need to categorize the post-cardiac arrest patients separately from the other cath patients. The other question I have for you guys is, you know, the CPR guidelines, the current ALS guidelines suggest that if the patient has a ROSCE within 10 minutes of CPR, they're a good candidate for thrombolysis. Do you think that number has moved? Has it extended beyond 10 minutes now? Or do you think 10 minutes is still a good guideline?
I can't really answer that question. I'm not sure. I think 10 minutes, and correct me if I'm wrong, was chosen because after 10 minutes, they felt the amount of CPR that had gone on was sufficient to cause enough trauma that would lead to bleeding. Don't quote me on that. That's just what I understand.
Yeah, that's my understanding too. I guess my question is, do we have evidence to actually support that? Is that speculation?
Well, I would speculate that after 1 minute of quality CPR, I've done all the damage I'm going to do. Everything should be good and crunchy. So I'm not so sure. Sorry, am I being taped? I'm not so sure that 10 minutes is evidence-based. It might be, but I don't think it is. I think it's a consensus time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it needs to be reevaluated.
Then you need to consider the machines out there doing the compressions. There was one case recently of a patient with a fractured liver and spleen after, I think it was an hour of or 45 minutes of pre-hospital CPR. Then they got to the hospital and hooked them up to one of the mechanical compression devices and kept them going for another hour. And multi-trauma patients usually aren't that injured.
That's terrible. Actually, you raise another interesting point that I thought about when I was reading the article that I reviewed here. And one of the things they talk about in terms of their data collection was whether the CPR guidelines met the 2005 standards or the 2000 standards, and they based that assessment on continuous ECG that was, you know, captured in the cardiac monitors, and they, you know, estimated the rate of compression by looking at the artifact on the ECG. You know, what's truly amazing now is the technology we have at our disposal. You know, devices that measure rate and depth. You know, rate and depth indicators and devices that provide automatic compressions. I mean, the ability to collect that kind of robust data now is just quite exciting. And, you know, is CPR is, and well, cardiac arrest management is just literally unfolding and evolving so rapidly right now. It's I think we're going to see some incredible things.
Blair, I think back to your question about, you know, are the educators and then the field personnel up to this task of transporting post-arrest patients? I think they are, especially if you know you're transporting to some place that's, you know, going to make it worth your while.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, or you're able to intercept with ground service coming from that center take the patient. I mean, you know, you sort of wonder, like, okay, if we're going to have this specialized cardiac arrest team at the hospital, you know, why not, especially in a large EMS system, why not have a specialized crew to transport these post-arrest patients?
And I think paramedics and EMTs, what they need most of all, I don't think most of us don't have an issue with transport, long transport times. I think the most important part will be getting the support from the medical community to say, okay, if you transport over 45 minutes to a cardiac arrest center and the patient arrests on you en route or re-arrests, you're not going to be held accountable for that. It's not your fault. It's perfectly fine. It's, you know, we're going to expect some of them to re-arrest. I think if they feel safe in doing that from a medical oversight perspective, I think it would be a good thing.
Yeah.
The implication, and I won't dwell on it too much, is that this is a big fight for STEMI bypass and stroke bypass in a lot of hospitals, is that you're bypassing what the hospital sees as a lot of dollar signs away from their door to one of their competitors. And this gets into some of the policy stuff, maybe not so much in Canada, but more so in the U.S., that also needs to be taken into consideration.
Absolutely. And I was just going to never mind. Go ahead, Tim. I forgot.
I was going to say the way we educate people, we are not currently educating them except in rural areas with the expectation that they will do long transports. They think, okay, we've got to get them to the closest hospital. Rob mentioned in urban areas. Where I am, it's suburban, and it's rare to have to go more than 10 minutes to hit a hospital, so it might as well be an urban area. They don't want to bypass hospitals a lot of the time.
There may be some cultural shifting that we need to do there as well as we move away from, you know, that idea of just load and go and get them to the hospital to actually providing medical care on scene and en route to hospital, where the final goal is not the hospital, but the care that we deliver en route to the hospital, no matter how long it takes us to get there.
Absolutely.
Well, gentlemen, I sure appreciate, Blair, first of all, for suggesting these four articles and for everybody preparing and participating in the conversation. And I think it's a good one to ask these questions and have these conversations, and also to end the evening, I guess, with more questions than we started with, you know, and not answers, but more questions and thoughts about what's possible, looking into the future and the roles that we might have as educators. And when the new guidelines come out, we'll have to revisit this issue, especially if how can we encourage our colleagues to make it happen faster. So thank you, everybody.
No problem. Thank you very much for inviting us.
Thank you.
Buck, you want to bring this home?
Sure. Thanks for everybody for coming. It was a fascinating talk. There's a lot of stuff going on out there. And you know what? It's going to change more. And it's something with the educators, you know. I often thought when I got into this business that if you worked on an ambulance, then you must be interested in science and evidence-based medicine. And you know what? It's not the case sometimes. A lot of times your employee base wants to do what they learned in school. I don't think we're ever going to get that changed unless we change the kind of education they're getting and change the mindset of the people who review this literature. And I can't tell you how many times I've seen, well, that's how they do it this week. It doesn't matter. They'll just change it again next week. It's a bad attitude to have. But keeping up with this stuff and listening right here to the Edgecast to get the new stuff is one way to keep up with it. And we will try and endeavor to keep our listeners up to date on this kind of stuff so that they can incorporate the new things and not repeat, you know, the first year 20 times, as we often say here. But anyway, Greg, what are we doing next week?
Next week we're continuing our focus in this interim session between semester one and semester two by talking about the field clinical or the field training experience and students, and if you actually have a cardiac arrest patient during your field time and how we can avoid relegating students to clipboard holder on those rare occasions that they actually get to have a cardiac arrest patient during their field time. And Bruce Nippon, who joined us last year in June, I believe, when we were talking about field clinical training, is coming back on for that show. And then Bill will also be back next week. And then in 2 weeks, Dr. Eisenberg's going to be back on. So
awesome.
January 20th. So cool. we're looking forward to this series. Blair and Tim, thanks again for joining us tonight for this Focus on Research.
No problem. And if anyone's interested in a little more resuscitation research, you can visit the University of Toronto's resuscitation website. It's called Rescue, www.rescu.ca.
All right.
Thank you also.
All right. Well, anybody else have any parting thoughts before we all say goodnight?
Thank you. It was a good talk.
All right, cool. Well, we'll see you next week. And again, out there, learn new things, enjoy new things, and don't hide your heads in the sand. There is new stuff out there. And thanks for seeing us on the EMS Educast.